I'm an alcoholic. I am not Jerry from Reading. I am a substitute. I play on the substitute team. I would like to tell you just very briefly that I drank. A lot of sad things happened to me. A lot of bad things happened to me. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and learned that I didn't have to have all those things happen to me due to drinking. Some of them happened to me because I was willful. But I sure as hell didn't. I wasn't drunk. That's the full thing, you know, as far as I'm concerned. I'm an alcoholic. This program works, and I know it works. I celebrated my 35th AA birthday in February. You know, I was thinking as I sat up here, when I first came here to Alcoholics Anonymous and looked around, I thought, look at all those old goats. And God, now I'm an old goat. Well, you know, this speaker that I'm about to introduce must be a character from the word goat. I'm sure I overheard him say that the woman that bought the winning raffle ticket got to spend the night with him, but I don't know. At any rate, that's what we're here for tonight. We're here to hear Ray, and here's Ray.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Ray Vowell, and I'm an alcoholic. I recently came from a convention in Arkansas, and somebody came up to me and said, are you an ANDA? And I don't know what the hell an ANDA is. I found out since that they're talking about those people that say alcoholic and an addict. I don't know if I'm an ANDA or not. I'll just tell you this much, that anything that made me feel single and see double, I would use it. Somebody asked me one time, said, what was your drug of choice? I said, what you got? Somebody asked me once if I was a social drinker. I said, I was if you had any whiskey. My drug of choice most of the time was whatever I could get. I preferred Finnegan suppositories. They can't smell them on your breath, but... I'm a member of the friendship group in Louisville, Texas, and I was looking out this beautiful crowd tonight. It's pretty neat. There's more people here that are in Flower Mound, Texas, where I live. Flower Mound is between Roanoke and Justin, so I know y'all know where that is. It's also 25 minutes from downtown Dallas, so that might help you find it. In Texas, we have a tradition that we do. We give our sobriety date. I know in some places they don't do this, but that's all right. You know, one advantage to my being up here and you being there is I can do what I want to. If you don't like it, you can leave. Somebody said, how long are you going to talk tonight? I said, till I get through. If you get through before I get through, go on. It's all right. The only time I've ever been in trouble speaking at an AA meeting is when I talked after I got through. If you'll stop as soon as you're finished, you'll be okay, you know. But some people have trouble doing that. So my sobriety date is July the 20th, 1971. And that may not mean anything to you, but I kind of like it myself. Thank you. I have also come to the conclusion that there are a lot of policemen, judges, lawyers, doctors, state hospital attendants, and especially my wife, who's also pretty fond of it. So, I suppose I might as well finish my introduction. I also am a preacher. I heard that way back. I am a Baptist preacher. I am a Southern Baptist preacher. I do not apologize for that. I'm no more ashamed of being a Baptist preacher than I am being an alcoholic. They're both incurable. You have to learn to live with them. Well, since you accepted that real well, let me explain one other thing to you. I'm also a practicing psychotherapist. So I'm everything that you have ever criticized, and that's all right. That's your problem. And so I work every day with people, you know, that are a hell of a lot sicker than you are, and they don't know why. You know, sometimes I sit and listen to all this garbage day in and day out, you know, and I have this overpowering urge to tell people, why don't you just go get drunk? I mean, hell, go out there and get drunk and stay drunk for 15 years and come back and I'll send you to some people that can help you, you know. I don't do that because it's not covered by Blue Cross. I want you to know that. So, you know, it kind of dawned on me that everybody talks about us and our disease. You know, we have a disease. We suffer from several diseases, as a matter of fact. But basically, you know, I think that we are probably the one vestige of sanity left in the world today. We are the most fortunate people on the face of the earth because we know what our problem is, we know what the solution is, and thank God a lot of us have found it. And it's like... As a psychotherapist, I am a professional people watcher, and I am of the opinion tonight that there are a lot of people out there that are a whole lot crazier than we are, and I don't know how anybody stay sober today without some sort of help in AA. I don't know how. I mean, whether you're an alcoholic or not, it would seem to me like the same thing to do would be just get drunk, because this world is so crazy. You look around you. I was coming through the airport the other afternoon, Friday afternoon, in Dallas, and I was waiting on my plane, and this boy and girl coming down through the corridor there in the airport, and he had a punk rock haircut. Now, I'm not critical. I'm just telling you that this one of these spike jobs that stands out about this far, it was blue on one side and orange on the other. And he stopped right in front of where I was at one of the concession stands. He picked up a pair of sunglasses, and he tried them on. He turned around to his girlfriend, and he said, "How do these look, honey?" And she said, "Take those off. They make you look stupid." And they say, "We're crazy." Well, 5 weeks ago, I was changing planes one Sunday afternoon in Chicago, and I had a layover, and I was sitting on a newspaper, and I didn't realize that a guy walked up to me, and he said, "Are you reading that paper?" I stood up, turned the page, and sat back down and said, "Yes, I am." And they call our disease insanity. I was in church the other morning. A lady passed by, and right in front of where I was sitting, and she had three little kids with her, about 6, 4, and 2, and she stopped right in front of where I was sitting and said to those kids, "Do you want a whipping?" That's got to be the dumbest question I've ever heard in my life. Can you imagine her reaction had those little kids looked up and said, "Yeah, Mama, beat the hell out of them." I went shopping this afternoon. There's a sign in one of the stores over in Old Sacramento in one of the windows that says, "Ears pierced while you wait." I told him I didn't have time to wait. I'd like to drop my ears off and pick them up in the morning. They don't have a sense of humor. They call the security guard. So I wonder, you know, how we ever get any sanity at all. You know, the government, you know, I mean, I don't want to get into politics tonight, but have you ever looked at the front door of the post office? Sign on the front door of every post office in this country. It says, "No dogs allowed except C&I dogs." Who the hell's supposed to read that? I So I decided some years ago that if I was going to have any vestige of sanity in my life, I needed to find some group of sane people. So I went off to the seminary and became the pastor of a Baptist church. I mean, we all know, you know, these people are spiritual, right? And I'm going to find sane people, right? So while I was in seminary, we had some pretty lean days. I was invited out to a little town in West Texas to preach a revival. Real neat place. Well, when you go to do that, what they do is they always sick you on some people that they're ashamed to visit or afraid of. They asked me to visit these three little old maids. Now, we don't say old maids in the Baptist church anymore. We say single by choice. However, in this particular case, I think if there had been a choice, but anyway, I told this story in Arkansas about 3 weeks ago, and a lady came up to me after, and she said, the old maid story offended me. I said, well, honey, don't worry, you'll get married someday. You know, so if you're offended, go look at somebody else. You know, I've been married to the same woman 35 years, and I won one argument in 35 years, and that's I'm smarter than she is. And I am. I'm a hell of a lot smarter than she is. Anytime she wants to argue about it, I just say, look at who you married. I wouldn't have married anybody like she did, and if I had, I wouldn't have stayed with him 35 years, I'll guarantee. I'm not capable of staying with her. I don't have her stick to it, her tenacity, but anyway, I'm visiting these three little old maids, and traditionally, they say, do you want some coffee? And I said, yeah. And they went in to get the cake and the coffee. All three of them go in the kitchen. And I'm sitting there. I look over, there's a bowl of peanuts on the table. I reached over, got a handful of peanuts. They still hadn't come back. I reached over and got another handful of peanuts. And they still hadn't come back. And before they got back, I'd eat that whole darn bowl of peanuts. It was embarrassing. It was a pretty big bowl. They came back in with the coffee and the cake, and one of the ladies said, I see you found the peanuts. And I said, yes, ma'am, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to eat all of them. She said, oh, hell, sir, I'm glad you did. Said, since we had our teeth full, we can't do nothing to suck the chocolate off of them. So we're sitting there drinking coffee and eating cake. And I looked up on the piano in that living room, and on the top of the piano there was a glass of water. And floating in this glass of water was a condom. And I'm trying not to look at it. Have you ever noticed when there's something you don't want to look at, no matter which way you turn your head, you're looking straight at it? I mean, I've got that problem down here on the front row tonight. I don't... And everybody should have that kind of problem. So I'm sitting there trying not to look, and I can't stand it. So finally I asked one of these ladies, I said, what is that? And she said, we don't know. We found it in the park. And it said on the package, placed on organ for prevention of disease. And we don't have an organ, so we put it on the piano. And she said, you know what, preacher, we haven't even had a cold all winter. So, you know, it's kind of like the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes, even when we don't know what it is, it'll work. We had a great week that week. I never will forget the first service. We started on Sunday morning. A little old lady in the church, about 85 years old, one of the founding pillars of the church. Every Baptist church I've ever been in has got a lady like this. About 85 or 90 years old. Been there, you know, since Noah landed. She's always late. Hard of hearing, sits down on the front row. Comes in late. I found out now, the reason she comes in late is the younger women outrun her to the bathroom between Sunday school and church, and she has to wait in line. Brings everything to church with it. She's got her own personal hymnal, her own personal Sunday school quarterly. She's got a sandwich in case she gets hungry. She's got a fan in case she gets hot, and a blanket in case she gets cold. Bag of medicine in case she gets sick. Yeah. Puzzle in case she gets bored. She brings everything she owns with her to church. Yeah. Maybe she's so old she thinks she might not go back home. I don't know. But anyway, we're starting church. Preacher's up leading, singing. Here comes this little old lady down there. She's got her hymnal and her Sunday school quarterly and her blanket and her fan and her sandwich and her medicine and her puzzles. Right on top of all of this is a roll of toilet paper. As she starts down the aisle, the toilet paper falls on the floor and she caught the end of it. And she starts pulling back, and the more she pulled, the faster it rolled. And the preacher didn't know what to do because it was the first thing that had come forward in the church in 3 years. He said, "Let's all stand and sing when the roll is called up yonder." So I told you all that just to simply say that the world out there may think we're crazy, but sometimes I wonder why we ever want to leave a meeting and go outside. I come here to get the sanity to go to church sometimes. Now, I'm going to tell you something. You know, our big book says that we're to accept nothing that cannot be reconciled. And I'm not going to stand up here and tell you things tonight that I cannot support. And I believe with all my heart that God loves us more than he loves anybody else in the world. In fact, I'm going to prove to you that. You see, we suffer from a lot of diseases. We don't just suffer from alcoholism. We suffer from all kinds of isms. But one of the most serious things that we suffer from is moreism. We want more of anything than anybody else. I never wanted one of anything in my whole life. I don't eat at the cafeteria because I want the whole line. I never took a girl home from a high school dance because I wanted to take them all home. And by the time I made my choice, somebody else already had all of them, and I'm out behind the gym puking, you know. God knows how we are. God knows that we all want more of everything than anybody else. So he gave the whole world 10 commandments, and he gave us 12 steps. Because he knew that if we didn't get more than everybody else, we weren't going to play anyway. On July the 19th, 1971, in Irving, Texas, I sat down with my wife one evening and I said, "Darling, being a well-motivated, highly intelligent, very educated young man, it would appear to me that alcohol has created some problems in our home." And she said, "Yes, it seems that way to me." And I said, "I believe I will just join Alcoholics Anonymous and get our lives straightened out." And she said, "Well, I certainly would be a supportive of that." And so I joined Alcoholics Anonymous on July the 20th, 1971. And our lives became manageable almost immediately. And my children began to have respect for me. And the neighbors began to elect me block captain. And I became president of the PTA. And the bank no longer sent me overdue notices, and policemen would wave at me as they passed, and And judges used to call me and ask my opinions on legal issues. And we've been deliriously happy ever since. Now, if you believe that, let's all stand and join hands and say the Lord's Prayer. Because you're too dumb to hear the rest of what I got to say. The fact of the matter is that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on July the 19th, 1971, for the simple reason I didn't have anywhere else to go. If I could have found one more person that would believe one more lie, if I could have run one more scam, if I could have borrowed one more dime, I would have still been out there drinking. My wife, who is a double-dip, triple-rededicated, born-again, Southern Baptist, educated, bred, raised, everything you can do, believed that marriages are made in heaven, but was kind of confused about hers, came to me on July the 19th, and she said, "The children and I have had a meeting, and we have audited you." And I said, "How did I make out?" And she said, "We have found out that it cost us $500 a month more to keep you than you bring in. And we just can't afford you anymore." I might at this point, at this time, point out to you that I was not living in my home. My wife and I had bought this home on a joint partnership. We used my GI loan and her money. And I was allowed to live in the garage. About once every other Saturday, they would put me out in the driveway and hose the garage out. And I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, because I had a pretty good life out there in the garage. Nobody placed a great deal of responsibility upon me, and for the most part, I was rather ignored, and I kind of liked that. And so I wasn't stupid. I was alcoholic. When she came to me and was going to dispossess me from my own garage, I said to her, "Maybe I need to call Alcoholics Anonymous." I knew all about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had called them about three times a week. You see, in Irving, they have an electronic answering machine. It says, "You have reached the Irving group of Alcoholics Anonymous." And then the most beautiful statement I had ever heard up until that time, "There's no one here at this time." I found out later it also says, "If you have an immediate problem, it gives you 6 phone numbers to call." I never knew that. Because what I would do is call, break the connection, and then confess. And I was a good confessor. And I would say, "Alcoholics Anonymous, let me tell you what I've done today." And then I would go in, and then I'd go back, and my wife would say, "What did they tell you?" And I would say, "They said maybe you ought not to drink red wine for a while. You ought to switch to white wine because it seems to be upsetting your personality." And she would believe that because she needed to believe something. And so I called Alcoholics Anonymous on this particular evening, hoping to get the answering machine, and I got a people on the telephone. Scared the tar out of me, because I just don't care much. I didn't care much for people, because, you know, people never done anything good for me. People will tell your wife where you've been when you disappear for a week. You know, people will fire you when you don't show up to work. People will send your checks back from the bank if you don't make deposits. Did you know that? I still got a terrible resentment about banks. All bankers are drunk. They're either drunks or crazy. Why else would they charge you $20 of what they already know you ain't got when you write a bad check? And they send you these stupid letters stamped final notice. And I went by there and said, "I appreciate it." They was beginning to bug me. They were lying. They sent me another one. You know, people. So I get this people on the phone, and I said, "I'd like to talk to somebody about drinking." And the guy said, "Are you able to come down here?" And I said, "Well, can you come if you've been drinking?" And he said, "Well, most people have." So I hung up the phone, and I went in and poured me a big glass of Mad Dog Deucey Deucey. I was in my ethnic period at this time, and Mad Dog Deucey Deucey is a fine old cultural wine. I'm a wine connoisseur. You know, you can tell the quality of a good wine by the number of threads on the screw cap. I mean, I know people drink that old cheap crap that they put corks in. And so I went in and poured me a glass of Mad Dog Deucey Deucey, and my wife said, "What are you doing now?" And I said, "Well, the man told me to have a drink and come on down there." Now, if you're going to be around alcoholics, you got to understand one thing, okay? And that is that alcoholics have this anatomical deficiency. It's physiological. They can hear anything they want to hear regardless of what's been said. And you know that if you've ever been around one, they can do that. And so I had a big glass of Mad Dog Deucey Deucey, and one of the problems is this language barrier thing, you know. Al-Anon, I love Al-Anon. I'm not going to stand up here and make any Al-Anon comments. I just want you to know that. Because if it weren't for Al-Anon, well, just if it wasn't for Al-Anon, you know. I mean, we love Al-Anons in Texas. We've got a new insurance in Texas just for Al-Anons. It's called My Fault. So one of the things about alcoholics and Al-Anons is they don't speak the same language. They really don't. They don't communicate at all. You know, it's kind of like, you know, an alcoholic will call home and he'll say, "Honey, I'll be home in a couple of minutes," and the Al-Anon thinks in 120 seconds he's coming in and out. Yeah. I mean, that just means sooner or later, you know. I finally got this figured out. My wife and I watch football. We watch pro football. We're sick. We watch the Atlanta Falcons. You know, good team. We got this new coach coming in from China. Win one soon. And things are going to get a lot better. So we watch football games on Sunday afternoon, you know, and they blow the whistle and the guy in the shirt will run over to this bench and he'll run over to that bench. And my wife said, "What are they doing?" I said, "It's a 2-minute warning." Every Sunday she gets up and goes to the kitchen. About 43 minutes later, she comes back and said, "Honey, supper's ready." I said, "Wait a minute, I can't, you know, we're on the three-yard line, goal to go." And she said, "The ball game been over 41 minutes. I said, "We got a minute and 20 seconds left to play." She don't understand that. She's never going to understand that. So if you're living with an alcoholic and he calls home and said, "I'll be home in a couple of minutes," that's your 2-minute warning. That's all it is. Don't mean a damn thing. So anyway, I have a glass of Mad Dog Deucey Deucey and I go down to the AA club. When I got there, it was gone. It didn't surprise me much because it wasn't at all unusual in those days for me to call somebody and tell them I was coming. They'd be gone when I got there. It happened a lot. I got the wrong address and I went to a real estate sales meeting. They look like alcoholics. I broke that meeting up and then I left. And I figured by this time my wife will know that I've made an honest effort to improve my life, and I went back home, and when I got there, everything I owned was on the front porch. Which was no big deal, it all fit in one pillowcase. And I timidly knocked on the door and asked if I could use her phone again, and she said, "Okay," and I called AA because I know by now they'll have the machine on. I can talk to it, she'll feel better, we can all get some sleep, and I can even get another drink. Honest desire to stop drinking. That's what they said. I didn't have an honest desire. I hadn't had much kind of a desire of any kind for a long time. So I called down there and got a people on the phone again. And I said, "Look, I think I got a drinking problem. I'd like you guys to come over here in 3 or 4 days and talk to me." And they said, "Well, we can come right now if you want to." Well, now, I got to tell you something, folks. I am an alcoholic, but I am not stupid. I mean, you know, everything I own's on the front porch. I've been kicked out of my own garage. My wife is standing there waiting for me to leave the house. And I got a lot of choices, right? You know, everybody says, "You got a choice." Yeah, sure I have a choice, but I slept in piano crates on the benches. I got to tell you something, it don't work. So I said, "Come on," and I told my wife, I said, "You and the kids get in the back of the house because big stuff didn't happen here." The real big stuff was I wanted them out of the way so I could get to the Mad Dog Douchey Douchey again. And I did have another big glass, and these two guys showed up. I know what's going to happen. See, they're going to come over to my house and tell me I can't drink, and I'm going to whoop them. I mean, it's just that simple. You know, life is simple for me. I don't have to have a lot of... I'm no rocket scientist. I don't have to have a lot of complicated stuff in my life. They're just going to say, you can't drink, I'm going to whoop their ass, and they'll go home. You see, that happened to me all the time. You know, people was always telling me, you can't drink. You know, my dad told me before I was 18 years old, said, son, you know, your problem is you can't drink. County judge, you know, when they ordered me out of the county, said, son, you can't drink. When the sheriff drove me to the county line, last thing he said to him, son, just remember, you can't drink. I joined the Navy, wound up in San Diego. I hadn't been down there 3 months. Some chief petty officer, you know, said, son, you can't drink. Judges told me, you can't drink. Doctors, lawyers. I've had total strangers look at me, laying flat on my back, picking straight up, say, son, you can't drink. Now, I don't know what they thought that was. But I got to tell you something. I wasn't much of a husband. I was a terrible father. I was non-productive as an employee, but I could drink. I mean, you cannot practice as long as I did without gaining some degree of proficiency. The most stupid thing anybody ever said to an alcoholic is, you can't drink. Now, you know, I can't drink and stay sober. I can't drink without going to jail. I can't drink without winding up in mental hospitals, but I can drink. I believe I still could. I'm just not willing to assume the responsibility for my actions. And so these two guys show up over at my house, and they come in, and this is two of the dumbest guys I have ever met in my life. They came in, and one of them said, first thing out of the back, said, take it easy. Well, heck, you couldn't take it much easier than I was taking it. Then one of them said, let go and let God. Well, I didn't have a hold of anything, and if I had, God certainly wouldn't have wanted it. And then one of them said, do you think you could go one day without a drink? And I said, well, of course I could. And they got smart alecky then, and he said, well, when did you? I said, well, I don't keep records of that sort of thing. You know, I'm sure that sometime I must have gone all day without a drink. But, you know, I have to tell you in all sincerity, for 19 years I've thought about this. I can't remember how long it had been since I had gone a 24-hour period without a drink. And they began to talk to me about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't want to take forever to tell this story, so I'll just simply say to you that the next day, July the 20th, I wound up at the Irving Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, 9:30 in the morning. Walked in the door, and the ugliest guy I saw in my life came up to me and stuck out his hand and said, I'm BJ. You're in the right place. Didn't even ask me if I needed to be there or anything. Just looked at me. Said, you're in the right place. Said, you want some coffee? I said, yes, sir. Brought me a cup of coffee. I took one sip and puked on the floor. And I knew my AA days was over right then, see, because when you puke on the floor, they make you leave. Always did. I puked on the same floor 3 times one day, and they made me leave every time. My wife says, with my education, I really shouldn't say puke, but I don't know how to describe what I did any other way. I mean, I have never barked, upchucked, or vomited in my life. I puked. I had the flu last month. You know, puking's like riding a bicycle. Once you learn how to do it, you don't ever forget. I can puke standing straight up without getting any on my shoes. I may get some on your shoes, but that's different. But you know, the guy didn't make me leave. He took me by the hand, took me over in the corner, set me down. Came back with a glass, big old glass, you know, and I know now he had honey, orange juice, and a raw egg in it. And a bucket. I didn't know what the glass was, but I knew about the bucket. And he said, sit down and drink this. And I did, and puked in the bucket. He went and got a mop, cleaned up the coffee and all the other stuff off the carpet. He came back with another glass of honey, orange juice, and raw egg. Drink this. I drank it and puked in the bucket. You know, it wasn't long after that till I looked up and those two guys had been at my house the night before showed up. And we had a good time all day. They sat around in a circle there watching me drink honey orange juice and raw egg and puking a bucket. And finally, about mid-afternoon, I said, why couldn't I just pour this in that bucket? You see, I'm an alcoholic. I'm not stupid. And they explained to me that every time I drank that, even though I was puking, that I kept a little protein and a little sugar down in my system, and it was keeping me from going into DTs, and that got my attention. I knew about DTs. You know, DTs are not funny. I had a country and western band that played in my bathroom. And I was the lead singer. See, one of the biggest shocks I got in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was when I sobered up and found out I couldn't play the guitar. Because I really thought if I'd have stayed drunk another month, I'd have been in Nashville. And I also am a gourmet cook. I'm a southern gourmet cook, and I used to cook for my band, and my favorite dish was grits. And I would cook them a box at the time. And if you cook a whole box of grits, nothing will hold them but a big salad bowl. And nothing is going to do in a salad bowl full of grits but a whole pound of butter or margarine. And then you can't eat those suckers with nothing but one of them big old salad spoons. Well, if you've got a big salad bowl full of grits and a pound of butter and a big salad spoon, you cannot eat them with your clothes on. You will get your clothes all greasy. So I would take my clothes off. And I weighed at that time 404 pounds. You would too if you ate a whole box of grits and a pound of margarine every night. Hunting was sweet. And you said, where you been? I slid. I mean, some guy's head of some major corporation in Dallas, you know, controls millions of dollars every day. He's got 4,000 employees, makes momentous decisions day in and day out, controls his whole destiny. You say, I hadn't seen you at a meeting, lady. He says, I slid. Don't that sound beautiful? Slid. Sounds better than I got drunk as hell, laid on my back, puked straight up. I fell in love with that word slip, but wouldn't anybody tell me how to have one? See, I thought what would happen is I'd be coming home one day and I would suddenly come drunk. And then I could drink all I wanted to and nobody could blame me because I would have slipped. So I began trying to figure out how you do this. One of my pet peeves in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I go to a meeting and the chairman says, does anybody have anything to discuss? If you're the chairman, you're supposed to have a topic ready. If you don't, by the time you get to the third speaker, you're going to be talking about sex. Because we love to sit around and talk about stuff we don't know anything about. It's okay, you know, to say if anybody's got a burning desire, but you ought to have a topic ready. You ought to know what you're going to do. That's why you volunteered to be the chairman and the leader. And I'd go to a meeting and say, anybody have anything you want to discuss? Let's talk about sin. Hey, what about sin? Finally, one night, a little guy came up to me, had about 14 years sobriety, you know, he said, let's me and you go in the Al-Anon room and talk while they have a meeting out here. And I thought he had some trouble and needed some help. So we go into the Al-Anon room, you know, and he looked at me, you know, and he said, Ray, I've been in AA 14 years. You're the phoniest SOB we've ever had here. I did exactly what you did. I would have done. I quit. I went home. They didn't appreciate me. I wouldn't go anymore. And I'm at home participating in the favorite pastime of alcoholics. I'm throwing chairs through doors, kicking holes in walls, smoking Winston cigarettes, drinking Maalox and black coffee and cussing. And my wife, who's very astute, said, you appear somewhat upset. And I said, I am. And I told her what Paul had said to me. And she said, why do you think he did that? And I said, he doesn't like me. And she said, nobody does. Why don't you find out what it's all about? So I pick up the phone. It never occurred to me it was 3:30 in the morning. And I called. Paul answered the phone. I said, Paul, why'd you do that to me? And he said, Ray, we have nothing to share, but I experienced strength and hope, and I've had the experience that you're looking for, and I hope by sharing it with you, you could be spared. Let me tell you what it'll be like. You've talked too much to ever drink in front of anybody again. Ray, you'll have to get something to drink, and I'll bet if the truth were known, you already have. And boy, that made me mad as hell. I didn't know how he knew that. I had a pint of whiskey I'd bought for a poor, sick, suffering alcoholic. Me. I mean, you know, if you're riding down the road and come drunk, you don't want to be running all over town hunting whiskey, right? I mean, if you're going to slip, you've got to have everything ready. I mean, slip's hard work. Ask anybody that's had one. And he said, what you'll have to do, you'll have to make a decision to go somewhere to take a drink, and then you'll have to decide to get whatever it is you're going to drink out from where you have it hidden. Then you'll have to decide to take the top off the bottle, you'll have to decide to turn it up, and then when you get it in your mouth, you'll have to decide whether or not you want to swallow it. And then if you're ever fortunate enough to walk into another AA club somewhere, you'll have to look the people in the eye and say, I got drunk because I wanted to be drunk more than I wanted to be sober, because that's the only reason there is. And I hated his brains and guts. He stole my slip. So I went back to AA and I sat down and I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't even wait for my turn to speak. I just didn't play. Except on Saturday night. Saturday night in the Dallas area, we have what they call beginner's meetings in some of the groups. And I love beginner's meeting. Beginner's meeting in Irving was held from 6 to 7 on Saturday night, and that was so they could clean the garbage out between 7 and 8 and have the real meeting from 8 to 9. Always had an old-timer set in the beginner's meeting, and I know now that his purpose was so it didn't get so deep somebody smothered to death. I loved the beginner's meeting. I was the chairman, teaching the newcomer. Beginner's meeting, if you've never heard one, it goes something like this. The first speaker would say, I used to drink shoe polish. Next one said, that ain't nothing. I used to drink kerosene lit. The next speaker would say, you know, I got drunk one time in Memphis and woke up in Nashville. The next speaker said, that's nothing. I got drunk one time in Hong Kong and woke up in Montreal, Canada, in my car. The next speaker say, you know, I've been married 8 times. The next speaker, that's nothing. I've been married 4 times since lunch. Twice to my sister, you know. I mean, you've been in meetings like that. And I'm sitting there waiting on my turn, you know. And we had this old guy, I mean, I just hated his brains and guts. He was about 27 years sober. His name was Curly, and he grinned all the time, you know. And he had this irritating habit of asking the group questions and looking straight at me. And I'd answer him. And so he stopped the meeting this Saturday night, and he looked right at me and said, I want to ask all you folks a question. He said, have you ever been so drunk you didn't remember what you did? And I said, well, of course. So I want to ask you one other question. He looked straight at me. So you ever wake up in the bed with a 95-year-old woman with sores all over her body? And I said, God, no. And he said, how you know? The other book that I work out of is called the Bible. I know it's not approved AA literature, but I read it anyway. And in that Bible, it says God works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform. And I want you to know tonight that that remark by Curly put me square into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked out of that meeting and I went to my sponsor's house. I have to tell you about my sponsor. He died last Christmas Day. Sorry's dirt. I made a career out of trying to get him one time to tell me what a good job I was doing in AA. And the kindest thing he ever said to me was, "I don't think you're going to make it." That was 6 months before he died. Al came up to me one day and he said, "My name's Al, and I'm your sponsor." I said, "I haven't chosen a sponsor yet." He said, "Yes, you have, and I'm him." I said, "I thought you got to choose your own sponsor." He said, "You do, you did, and I'm him." I said, "I'm not sure I'm ready for sponsorship." He said, "Hell, me either." And then he looked at me and he said, "You don't understand, do you?" And I said, "No, sir, I don't." He said, "We drew straws and I lost." You see, in October of 1971, there was a meeting of the steering committee of the Irving Group of Alcoholics Anonymous to make a decision on whether or not they were going to allow me to continue to attend meetings. And the decision was that if they made me stop coming, I would probably die. But if I was going to be allowed to continue to come to meetings, somebody had to be responsible and take charge of me. And they actually drew straws, and I lost. And that's how I got my sponsor, the best one that ever lived on the face of this earth. And I went to Al. Thank you. I went to Al's house that night after Curly had asked me that question, and I knocked on the door, and I was standing there with tears running down my face, and Al looked at me, and he said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "A terrible thing has happened." And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "I've just found out. I don't know what I've done." And he said, "Ray, none of us do." And I said, "To hell with the rest of you. I'm talking about me. I don't know what I've done." And it was terrifying. For the first time in my life, I realized that there was a period that I had no idea what I had done. And he said to me, "What does that mean to you?" And I said, "It means that I can never again look down my nose at another human being because I don't know what I've done. I can never again judge you because I have no idea of what I've done." And Al looked at me and he said, "Ray, it just might be that you're ready to take certain steps." And he didn't say read a book or come back next week. He said, "Come in." And we began a program that has lasted up until today. And Al began to teach me things, and he taught me that, "Ray, there are three meanings to AA. There's absolute abstinence, there's Alcoholics Anonymous, but the most important critical meaning of AA is admitted and accepted that we truly are powerless over alcohol, and our lives have become unmanageable, because the two working tools of every alcoholic man or woman or child in this country and anywhere else in the world today are rationalization and justification. And as long as we can rationalize away what we've done and justify what we're about to do, we'll keep doing it." I didn't understand that. I was in a meeting in Arlington, Texas one Sunday morning. The phone rang. The guy motioned for me to pick up the extension. A lady on the other end, she said, "I'm drunk." The guy said, "Well, I'm sorry to hear that. You were doing so well. You had almost 11 months sobriety." She said, "It's not my fault. It's the peanut butter." He said, "I don't understand. You got drunk on peanut butter?" She said, "No, hell no. We don't have any peanut butter. My husband came home and threw a fit. And I went down to 7-Eleven and I bought 2 6-packs and I drank all 12 of them." And she said, "Wouldn't it have been simpler?" He said, "Wouldn't it have been simpler just to have bought a jar of peanut butter?" And she said, "To hell with him. I don't care if he never gets any more peanut butter." And you laugh about that tonight, but I challenge you, how many times in your life have you deliberately started a fight so you could slam the door and go off and get drunk? How many alcoholics have you ever met in your life who said to their mate, "Honey, I'm going out and screw my head up for a week. I may run over a neighbor's kid or two on the way out of the neighborhood. You know, I'm probably going to sleep with 2 or 3 people while I'm gone. I'll steal some money. I may lose a job, probably go to jail and definitely be in the hospital. But don't worry. I'll be back." No, you never heard that in your life. I didn't have much trouble with step two. I know what insanity is. Insanity is doing the same thing the same way over and over again, hoping to get a different result. I did it for 20 years. I can remember saying to my wife, "Honey, don't let the neighbors know I've been drinking." She'd say, "How must I explain you being naked out in the yard?" I said, "Tell them I'm sick." I remember once being taken to a psychiatrist. I don't have anything against psychiatrists. We all got psychiatrist stories, and we laugh and make jokes about them. Psychiatrists, the only problem with psychiatrists, we lie to them. You go to a psychiatrist, he say, "Do you drink some?" "How much?" "I don't know, just to relax." I used to do that. I drank to relax. Sometimes I get to relax, I couldn't move 2 or 3 days. So my wife carried me to this psychiatrist, you know, and he looked at me and said, "Son?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I'm going to give you some pills." I said, "You are?" He said, "Uh-huh." I love pills. I just want y'all to know, if this offends your pure AA nature, I apologize. But I love pills. I love big pills, little pills, white pills, red pills, long pills, short pills, fat pills, skinny pills. I just love pills. Back when I was drinking, when I come to your house, first place I went was your bathroom. I want to look in your medicine cabinet. I've taken enough Midol in my life, I wouldn't have a cramp if I lived to be 150 years old. I never will forget the first time I found the little plastic thing with the dates on it. I took the 25th, 26th, and 27th. I have a very dear friend who died last week. He's a Jesuit priest up in Ottawa, Canada, and Father Time used to say, "Ray, did it ever occur to you, you may be responsible for getting some woman pregnant you didn't even meet?" So I'm sitting there in this doctor's office, and he said, "I'm going to give you these pills." I said, "What do they do, doc?" He said, "They make you deathly sick if you drink." I said, "Hell, I already get deathly sick when I drink." He said, "You mean you know you're going to get deathly sick and you drink anyway?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I don't understand that. I sneeze." So he gave me some pills, and you know, the old boy's pretty smart. I got deathly sick. I liked the diet. I stayed in intensive care 2.5 weeks, and I guess I would have stayed longer, but I drank the alcohol out of the thermometer glass, and they discharged me. But I never did take any more antabuse. I'm not stupid. I'm an alcoholic. And then we got to step three, folks, and I got to tell you something, boy. I had a problem. I went to Al, you know, and I said, "You got to help me. You got to help me with this God thing, Al." See, my concept of God was that he'd been sitting up there on a cloud with a pair of binoculars. And every time I got about halfway up, he sent somebody to knock me back down. It used to be an old country and western song, "God's going to get you for that," you know, and I just knew he was waiting to do it. And the fact is, if God were going to get you for that, he'd already got you. You know, the fact of the matter is this. I just didn't have any understanding of God. I went to Al and I said, "You got to help me with God." And he said, "No, I can't do that, Ray." He said, "It's God, it's your understanding." And I struggled and I struggled and I struggled, and I'm trying to make God fit the understanding that I've had all my life, and that is that I must be absolutely perfect or I will fail. You see, the problem with the God consciousness in the world today is that we're all trying to live up to the ideal that somebody else told us that we're supposed to have. I grew up in churches in South Georgia, and adults were telling me that if I didn't do these things and these things and these things, God would not love me, and I would fail to do those things, and I would be frightened. And then as I became a teenager, I realized that the very people who were telling me that if I didn't do this and this and this, God was not going to like me, were doing exactly the things they were telling me not to do, and I became confused. And by the time I'm 18 years old, I've done all of these things that they've told me God won't like me for, and the fact of the matter is, it's a barefaced lie. This is just their way of trying to control me. I got to tell you something, folks. Religion has done more in this country today than I think we'll ever live to straighten out. Thank you. Because, you see, in my opinion, religion is man trying to impress God with how good he is. But I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you taught me the value of spirituality, which is simply being humble enough to let God show you how good he is. I teach two courses in a seminary. I had a young preacher come up to me not too long ago. I've been waiting for years for this. Came up to me and said, "Dr. Vowell," I said, "Yes." Said, "Could you give me your philosophy of religion?" I said, "Yes, I can, son." And he got out his notebook and his pen. And he's all ready for these words of wisdom. And I said, "This won't take but a minute. God will give you what you need, when you need it, just as soon as you're capable of taking care of it. That's it." We began to work a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not real satisfied, and my wife had gone back to church, and I was real anti-church. And I hear a lot of this today, you know, in AA, and I don't try to win you over, you know. I've always believed, and I still believe, that you should not make earth-changing or life-changing decisions for at least a year, and that may include going back to church. Because it's been my experience, if you go back to church too soon, you're going to go to church and try to sober up all the drunks at church, and they're going to run you off. Then you're going to go back to AA, and you're going to try to save all the drunks, and they're going to run you off. Then you're going to get frustrated and get drunk again. So get your feet on the ground and don't get so heavenly high you're no earthly good. So I finally went back to church. My wife talked me into going back to church, and I went to church one day, and I didn't like it. I told them that. You know, we're told today, "Hey, you know, you got something on your mind, talk about it." So I told them. I said, you folks don't know nothing at all. You know, nobody hugged my neck while I was down there, you know, and went outside, nobody shook my hand. And I told the preacher, I said, "Y'all want to know something about love, y'all come over where I go every night. Those folks know how to love each other. I almost caught a cold sitting in here. You could have hung meat in here, it was so cold." I'm sure he loved that, you know. Smart aleck preacher. Came over to my house Tuesday night, sat down in my living room, looked me right straight in the eye and said, "Ray, if you think you've got something that we're supposed to have, maybe God's chosen you to bring it to us." So I'm sitting at home on Sunday afternoon. I went back to church. I'm going to church, and I'm getting real confused. I mean, I'm getting really confused. You know, I go to AA and I see love over there, and I go to church and they talk about love, and I go back to AA and they're doing it. And then I go back down to church and they're talking about it. I go back to AA and I say, "Something wrong here." I mean, there's something definitely wrong. I mean, you know, at least at AA they love you and they don't take the money till they get through talking. At church they take it before they ever say anything. You know, it's like, something wrong. Somebody asked me at dinner what I thought about television evangelists. I'm sorry, I missed out on all that. You know, I mean, I'd like a job where you tell your people to send your money to God and give you their address. You know, I mean, it seems to pay off real well. I've always wanted my own amusement park. You know? And I've been to New Orleans. That ain't bad. So I'm sitting at home one afternoon and I'm reading. I got the Bible open in one hand and big book in the other. I don't recommend that. I mean, really. I mean, I'm serious. I don't think that every alcoholic ought to be a preacher. I don't think that every alcoholic ought to be a counselor either. Because I want to tell you now tonight, as a trained professional psychotherapist, that being an alcoholic does not prepare you to be a counselor any more than having your appendix out makes you a surgeon. If you're going to be a counselor, you need to learn some skills so that you can recognize the danger point, okay? That's just my own little personal thing, and I'm not jealous. I got a lot of patience I give you. So I'm sitting there with the Bible in one hand and the big book in the other, and I keep looking, and it keeps saying, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. And I look over, and the Bible's open at the ninth chapter of the book of Acts, which is the account of St. Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus, where God took one of the worst men that ever lived and made something useful out of him. And I look back over here, and it said, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him, and I understood. And I picked up the phone, and I called this little preacher, and I said, I believe God has called me to preach. He said, we all know that. I said, how can I be sure? He says, by 9 o'clock tonight, there won't be a doubt in your mind. I said, how do you know that? He said, because at 7 o'clock tonight, you'll be bringing the evening message in our services. I said, you're kidding. He said, no. I went into the living room, and I said to my wife, I think God has called me to preach. She said, what and to who? That night, I got to church. I got one of the biggest shocks that I've ever had. Somehow my group had found out what was going on at the church. And there must have been 40 drunks sitting in that church. Some of them had never been in a church before. And I stood in that pulpit that night and I brought the message that God had given me to bring to those people. And I have never felt more at peace and more comfortable in my whole life. And I knew that God had touched my life and that I had something that I had to do. I went to Southwestern Seminary the next day to apply for studentship, and they told me there wasn't any way because the classes started on Thursday and it would take at least 6 weeks to complete the enrollment process. And they gave me a ream of paper that high, and I had to get recommendations, and I had to get all this past checkup, and I had to get investigations, and I had to get about 20 preachers to sign that they would recommend me. And I went back, and I'm sitting in Al's office, and Al said, I don't think you're called to preach. I think it's just some wild idea you've got, but if that's what you want to try to do, he said, we'll do it. And I said, there ain't no way, because I got all these papers. Al got on the phone, called about 20 drunks, and divided those papers up, you know, and he said, I want these back. He said, I want these back by 5 o'clock, and the next morning I went back to the seminary with all the papers completed, and they said, we don't believe this, but I got in. So I graduated from the seminary, you know, and I come out and I got a Billy Graham haircut and a Pat Robertson suit and a Oral Roberts shoes and a Jim Baker Bible, which is for sale. And we're living down in Beeville, Texas, Faith, working at South Texas Children's Home, and I'm down there and nobody was looking for a 40-year-old recovering alcoholic Baptist preacher with no experience. And here I am ready to go, and there's nothing any worse in the world than a preacher with a whole barrel full of sermons and nowhere to put them. And I'm sitting there feeling sorry for myself, and my wife said, go to AA. And I said, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The meeting doesn't start till 8. She said, go on anyway. So I drive down to 310 South Adams Street in Beeville, a little white house where the AA club met and the group met. And there was a car sitting in front, and I walked in. There's one guy sitting over in the corner, and I went in, and there was a pot of coffee on. I got a cup of coffee. This guy walks over, sticks his hand out, and he said, my name's Carr, and I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I'm Ray, and I'm an alcoholic. He said, Ray, what do you do? And I said, I'm a Baptist preacher. And he said, you are? And I said, yeah. He said, you got a church? I said, huh? I'm at large. And you know, a funny thing happened. Tears began to run down that old man's face, and he said, Ray, my brother-in-law is the pastor at Calvary Baptist Church, and he's had a heart attack, and they won't let him preach anymore. And I had come down here this afternoon to just kind of talk to God, to ask him that he might send us a preacher that would understand people like us. And Carr carried me that afternoon to 7 different homes and introduced me to the 7 deacons of Calvary Baptist Church. And the next Sunday morning, I preached there, and they voted unanimously to call me as their pastor. And I spent 8 years as pastor of that little church. I celebrated my 8th birthday in that church one Sunday night, and it was half alcoholics and half Baptists. And I realized that God still had something useful for me to do in spite of everything I'd done. There's another passage in the Bible that says, all things work together for good to them that love God and are called according to His purpose. And I could never reconcile that. I said, all of the things that I've done and all the pain that I put my family through and all the embarrassment, How could anything good ever come out of that? But I got to tell you something, folks, it's all experience. It's all experience, and God can use any experience you've had. You see, our experience, strength, and hope does not just belong to us in this room. It belongs to a world out there that still needs our help. Nine years ago, I said to Faye, I'd like to go back to school and get my doctorate. She said, why don't you? I said, I'd be 50 years old before I graduate. She said, honey, in 4 years, you're going to be 50 either way. So I reapplied to the seminary and was accepted. On January the 2nd, 1984, I turned 50. On May the 14th, 1984, I graduated summa cum laude with a Ph.D. in Christian psychology. On October the 15th, 1984, our daughter presented us with the most perfect, most intelligent, most absolutely beautiful little red-headed grandson that's ever been born. We now have another one who's 2 years old, and he's even more perfect than the first, and my daughter's expecting another one, and I've ordered a little girl. One of the confusions of my life is how the boy who was not good enough to marry my daughter can father such perfect children. If it were not for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have missed all those things. I've left out part of the story that I usually tell about how Al and I shared with each other and how he helped me to realize the beauty and the benefits of this program. I have a 34-year-old son, 6'5", 240 pounds. We have a lot of problems sometimes. He grew up in an alcoholic home. He has a real hard time accepting the fact that he has his father's unconditional love. But I got to tell you something. He very seldom lets 2 days pass that he doesn't call me. And it's very rare that he calls me, that he doesn't say, Daddy, I love you and I'm proud of you. When our oldest grandson was 2 years old, he had never spent the night away from his mother and father. I was attending the School of Prophets at First Baptist Church in Dallas. I had a suite in one of the hotels in Dallas. My daughter came to me and she said, Daddy, how would you like to take Ryan and keep him all night? And I said, you would let me do that? And she said, yes, I would, Daddy. And I went down to Walmart and bought $40 worth of little red trucks. Because I don't want to spoil him. And we were sitting in that hotel room, my wife and I, with that little boy. And he would play with those trucks, and every little while he would throw them down, and he'd come and climb up in my lap, and he'd put his arms around my neck, and he'd say, Papa, I love you. And he would get down, and he'd run off, and he'd play, and a little while he'd come back, and he'd put his arms around my neck, and he'd say, Papa, I love you. And I cried. I didn't cry because the little boy said, I love you. Little boys do that with their grandfathers. I cried out of gratitude because that night I knew that my daughter, who used to be so afraid of her father that she would lock herself in the bathroom and sleep in the bathtub, had trusted me with the most precious possession she had, her child. And it was that night that I knew that not only am I recovering in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and not only have I been forgiven by God, myself, my family, and other human beings, but I have been restored to the place where I would choose to be had none of this ever happened. And I would like you to know that if I could choose any place in the world where I could be tonight, I would choose to be standing here with you feeling the love that you send up this way, and thanking you for allowing me to share my love, my strength, and my experience and hope with you. I'm no expert in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have none. Sober's as high as you get. I believe in the simplicity of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would like to close by sharing with you what mine consists of. Number one, I know which drink makes me drunk. It's the first one. And number two, I know who, with God's help, has the choice of whether or not I take it. And that's me. And I thank you, and God bless you.